Welcome to Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. On this podcast, we'll be discussing nonviolent readings of Latter-day Saint Scripture. I'm Dan, and I'm joined by my wife and co-host, Marianne.
The Latter-day Peace Studies Project is born out of a desire to proclaim peace by providing an opportunity to approach religion, Scripture, and relationships with God in a peaceful way. As we develop peace within ourselves first, we can reflect peace into the world around us. The Latter-day Peace Studies Presents Come Follow Me podcast seeks to assist listeners in their approach to Scripture by providing nonviolent interpretation. Our hope is that we can integrate the teachings of the Scriptures into our efforts to find peace within ourselves and proclaim peace in the world. Welcome back to Latter-day Peace Studies Presents Come Follow Me. This week, we are studying Mosiah chapters 7 through 10, and there's kind of a lot going on in these chapters. There's a lot of events happening really quickly, and that there are flashbacks and then flashbacks and the flashbacks, and like we're getting lots of moving parts and pieces here. So we're going to try to make sense of just situating us in the story a little bit, and then we're going to dig in a little bit deeper. So in chapter 7, we hear about this group in Zarahemla that wants to know what happened to the people who went looking to settle the land of Lehi-Nephi because they haven't heard from them. And doing some of the math, it seems like it works out to about 70-ish years later. Is that right, Dan?
Somewhere right about 70 years.
So they get permission after teasing Mosiah that King Mosiah grants that 16 of their strong men might go up to the land of Lehi-Nephi to inquire concerning their brethren. So this sort of like scouting group led by a man who was a descendant of Zarahemla named Ammon. And this is not the Ammon who's the son of Mosiah who comes on the scene later. So there are at least two Ammons that we're speaking of in the Book of Mormon. But so this Ammon...
Also, this is King Mosiah 2. So the first group was sent out by King Mosiah 1, and now we've got a group sent out by King Mosiah 2 to go check on that first one.
Exactly. And the leader of this group is Ammon, a descendant of Zarahemla, which we said, which I think is really interesting that he is leading this expedition not back to his place of origin. Like, he's from Zarahemla, and so I think it's really interesting that he's the leader here. But I think referring to him being a strong and mighty man, I think it's curious that he could have possibly been the rightful heir to the kingship in Zarahemla before Mosiah gets there.
Yeah, Ammon is one of the most common names in the Book of Mormon. We're going to see a bunch of Ammons. We'll see a bunch of Ammonihahs. I think Hugh Nibley pointed that out. I don't remember what Hugh Nibley said that Ammon meant, but it seems almost Egyptian, like Amun. Mm-hmm. I know. So I've seen a few theories about that. The other comment to bring up here is, yeah, it's interesting that he has this desire to go back to the land of someone else's fathers. And I wonder if part of it is because the Nephites also came from Jerusalem and the people of Zarahemla also came from Jerusalem. And so he's like, well, we both have Jerusalem in common. Maybe now we can have the original land of Nephi in common.
Yeah.
Because we've got Zarahemla in common. So we've got two out of three common lands. Let's see if we can go three for three.
It is just like a really interesting choice, I guess, in the leader of this group and why he would go out. But he definitely seems curious and wants to know what's going on. So it takes him about 43 days. Is that right?
Well, 40 days they came to a hill. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they go in to look closer at the city and they're outside the walls and they get captured by a group of guards. And then they find out that it's the king of the land and his guards have taken them captive. Dan, you pointed out this difference, this contrast between what Benjamin just established in their land. He abolished all their prisons.
So he abolishes all the prisons and abolishes the taxes, or at least, you know, makes the tax very bearable. Then Ammon and his group come and they're immediately tossed into prison. And they find out that, oh, this group, you know, we're going to find out that they're taxed up to 50%, I think is what's said later, like a very grievous tax. But just a note about like the hill Shilom, the hill in the north of Shilom. This hill is going to show up again, and it's one of many hills in the Book of Mormon. And it's one of those things that, I mean, growing up, I read the Book of Mormon a bunch. I thought I knew the Book of Mormon pretty well, but then I'm just like, oh, there's this hill, and it's mentioned like three other times. I never put that together before. And there's, you know, a bunch of other hills that show up. There's like Rip Lake-ish and around rivers. And yeah, if you just go find a full text of the Book of Mormon sometime online, Gutenberg has one. If you just Control F hill, you'll be like, oh, there's a lot more hills in here than I ever thought.
They don't really use the word mountain. They use hill a lot more often. And that's interesting.
Well, Nephi goes up into a mountain, and the brother Jared goes up into a mountain, but there's some other ones, but those are right. The big ones.
They use that more as an experience with God, unless it's a geographical feature.
Yes.
It seems so. And I also think it's interesting to note that Limhi identifies himself as the son of Noah, who was the son of Zenith, who came up out of the land of Zarahemla to inherit this land, which was the land of their fathers, who was made a king by the voice of the people. So he recognizes that Zenith was basically elected their leader, but he doesn't claim to have been chosen by God, which Benjamin does. Limhi claims lineage, but Zenith doesn't claim any special lineage to be the ruler of the people. They just want him to be. So I think that's an interesting way that they're sort of showing, again, a contrast between Noah, especially, and Benjamin.
Yeah, just another note that Ammon, one of the people that he takes with him in this initial foray, is named Amalekai. Not the Amalekai who handed over the plates to King Benjamin, but potentially named after him. We know that that Amalekai had a brother who went with the first group, if you're following. And I think Ben was the one who pointed out in some of our chats that he thought maybe Abinadi was the brother of Amalekai 1, which is really interesting to think about. We're going to talk a lot more about Abinadi next week or the week after?
Yeah, next week.
We get a little preview of him here in this reading this week. But it's interesting to think that maybe Abinadi was with that first initial group and that he was the brother of the record keeper. I got to jump ahead a little bit here because we see that Limhi and his people have been keeping records. So where did they get the knowledge of those records? He's going to quote some things that feel like they're straight out of First Nephi. Maybe he has copies of the brass plates. We're going to see King Noah's priests quote Abinadi, or not quote Abinadi, but quote Isaiah. And so clearly they're familiar with it. So there's some record that's being kept with the group that Mosiah 1 sent off. And so my theory is that if Abinadi is the brother of Amalekai, and Amalekai was the last keeper of the small plates, maybe Amalekai prepped Abinadi for that keeping of the plates, maybe even giving him the knowledge of how to make new plates. But Abinadi went with this group, the first group, under Mosiah 1, and then Amalekai gets old, and he's like, well, I can't do anything, but we've got now a prophet king, right? Not just a regular king, so I'm just going to hand over the small plates to him. And that's where Benjamin takes over. We get the merging of the small and large plates. So I don't know. This is a wild string theory. And I'm going to have a few probably in this reading. So this is just the first one. But if you like that, buckle up. We've got more to go.
Yes, exactly. Well, because we're trying to go off of just these bits and pieces that we have, right? We're trying to weave these things together. And again, so many more questions for the keepers of the record. And I have a lot of questions for them. So when Ammon tells King Limhi and his guards who he is, Limhi immediately rejoices and is so excited and says, now I know of a surety that my brethren who were in the land of Zarahemla are yet alive. And so I think this is like a deep cultural fear that they have because of Lehi and his family leaving Jerusalem and then later learning that Jerusalem had been destroyed. There's no home to go back to. And that's the way that Limhi and his people had been feeling after Limhi had sent out a search party later. Again, we're talking about these hopping timelines here, but that Limhi sends out a search party looking for the people in Zarahemla and they can't find it, but instead they find this totally destroyed civilization and bring back plates from it. And that ends up being the record of the Jaredites and the destroyed Jaredite civilization. But it's really interesting and I think pulls at your heartstrings a little bit that they had this deep fear, right, that they were the only ones left now and that they were all alone, because that's exactly how Lehi's family felt. And then again, how Nephi felt. And then again, how Mosiah the first felt when they had to leave, that kind of. And so to find out that the place that they came from, the people are still there and they're looking for them and they care about them. And that must have been a deeply relieving feeling for Limhi, I think. And then Limhi gathers all his people together to the temple to hear the words which he should speak unto them. So he's following this pattern here, right, of the kings gathering their peoples to the temple, or the priests gathering their people to the temple. And I do wonder, this temple here, whether it's Nephi's original temple or if it's a new one. Because they talk in later chapters, Zenith talks about having to rebuild the walls of the city and stuff. So there was clearly some destruction that had happened, but whether the temple or the temple had been corrupted because they didn't have the priesthood there, or I mean, I don't know. So whether this is Nephi's same original temple or whether it's a rebuilt one, the people of Limhi have a temple there.
I wonder, because I don't know that King Limhi, he has no knowledge that Benjamin gathered his people to the temple, but he's going to have some knowledge that Jacob gathered people to the temple, that Nephi gathered his people to the temple. And so he's probably like, well, who was the last good king we had? Oh, well, Nephi, right? And so, okay, well, we gotta gather to the temple, right? That's the thing that we need to do. And possibly, again, if they have some copy of the brass plates, they have some record, they maybe are like, hey, we have to keep these holy days where we gather everyone to the temple and practice covenant renewal. And maybe they haven't been doing it the way that they should. And there's some indications that, you know, this group has not been keeping up with the obligations and covenants that they're supposed to. But they go for another time when they gather to the temple and there's this like little bringing together, an at-one-ment, an atonement ceremony led by the king where the people are reconciled to each other.
It's really beautiful. So he gathers people together and speaks to them. I have to say, from Limhi's speech, that he really does seem to have a way with words, that he seems to be a really powerful speaker. And he gives this rousing, the Lord has sent people to come and rescue us, and our prayers have been heard. And if we put our trust in God and do our best to follow the commandments now, like he will keep his promises and he will save us. And it's because of our own iniquities and abominations that we've been brought into bondage. And then he talks about all the difficult things that they have endured, and then talks about how it was because of their own sins. And he outlines, or he articulates two of these specific sins that the Lord is punishing them for, or rather allowing them to be punished by the Lamanites. And he doesn't put the blame of their difficulties on the Lamanites. He puts it on themselves, that their unwillingness to keep the commandments, right, has not led to them prospering in the land. So the two problems, the sins from on the people that has led to their bondage, he says in verses 25 and 26, he says, they would not hearken unto his words, meaning the Lord's words, but there arose contentions among them, even so much that they did shed blood among themselves. So that's the first sin. And a prophet of the Lord have they slain, yea, a chosen man of God, who told them of their wickedness and abominations, and prophesied of many things which are to come, yea, even the coming of Christ. And then he outlines a little more of the teachings of Abinadi. So they started killing each other, and then they killed the prophet, which is exactly the problems that Jerusalem was having when Lehi was led away. Those are their sins that the Lord is punishing them for, or again, or allowing them to be punished, depending on your perspective on that. And then he tells his people, but if you will turn to the Lord with full purpose of heart and put your trust in him and serve him with all diligence of mind, if you do this, he will, according to his own will and pleasure, deliver you out of bondage. I think this is a beautiful testimony from Limhi. And I wonder, him being the son of King Noah, I wonder how he gained this testimony, gained this knowledge. He doesn't talk about his own spiritual journey and growth, but I find him to be a really interesting and compelling figure. And I wish I knew more about him and his testimony, but I think this is really beautiful. And how he tells his people, we aren't talking many generations later. This has been about three generations. And so the people that he wants to call to repentance, this is in their own lifetimes, right? That they need to repent. And he says, it's still possible. The Lord is still offering that to us.
I want to go back in a little bit to what he identified that Abinadi said that made the priests of Noah so mad. Mm-hmm. Because he says, because he said unto them that Christ was God, the Father of all things, that he should take upon him the image of a man, and it should be after the image after which man was created in the beginning. Or in other words, he said that man was created after the image of God, and that God should come down among the children of men, take upon him flesh and blood, and go forth upon the face of the earth. This is a fascinating pattern that we see, and we've seen subtle hints and indications before. What was Sherem? Sherem the Antichrist. What was his big issue? Is that Jacob was teaching about someone to come, right? That Christ, you had to go trust in Christ, which was going to be someone in the future who would come down and save everybody. Well, there's this theme and undercurrent in the Book of Mormon that I think recent scholarship has identified as suggesting that the Deuteronomist reforms under King Josiah were excessive and potentially not great. And what is one of the things that the Deuteronomists have a specific impact on? Well, you go read Margaret Barker. She says the biggest thing is they remove the physicality of God, the appearance of God to people. You have times in the Hebrew Bible where God is very, he wrestles with Jacob, right? He meets Moses face to face. He dines, he eats with the elders of Israel in the mountains with Moses. He walked with Enoch, right? A very physical, corporeal God. And the Deuteronomists come in and they redact and make the edits to say, no one's seen God at any time. You can only see the spirit, or there's a bunch of different things. And I mean, Margaret Barker's written a lot about this. Dave Butler has written a lot about this. Some of these things where it's like, okay, so the priests of Noah, the wicked priests, had the same pattern of rejecting this corporeality of God and the relation of God and people that we see from some of the Josiah reforms. So this pattern shows up again. And again, if you want to get more corkboardy, this is a pattern that I think we can trace back to Cain. But I'm not going to do that right now. Maybe I'll make the case for that later in the Book of Mormon. But it's something that once you see this pattern, it's going to pop up again and again. And we'll see some indications later about what we learn about the temple. And again, the Book of Mormon is focused on the temple. And what's one of the things that the temple does, right? It brings you into the presence of God. So
you yourself, not through an intermediary.
Right. Yeah. And so God coming down to his holy of holies, well, actually, it's not limited to that. God's actually going to come to the whole earth. Anyways, just to point out that Abinadi is teaching something that we don't see in the Old Testament. And one of the things that we get in the Book of Mormon is that plain and precious truths have been removed from the Old Testament. And there's really only, well, I mean, there's a bunch of different times, right, when the children of Israel mess up. But there's a big notable time that happens right before Lehi and Nephi leave Jerusalem, the major reform that makes a bunch of changes that are masked as rediscoveries under the law, that might indicate that this pattern is something that we should keep an eye out for.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. I'm going to couch it as much as I can, even though I believe
it strongly. We will cover more of that when we get to Abinadi and Abinadi's teachings and prophecies. But
yes,
we got to keep setting the stage here because we have several intricate threads running through here. So in chapter 8, we get some interjections from Mormon, kind of summing some things up and kind of telling us what happens to connect these pieces together. So we get the word I, right, in the first verse, and that's I, Mormon. And then we get I, you know, later in verse 7, and that's Limhi. It's I, Limhi. And anyway, so we just kind of have to keep track of who's narrating right here, right, and who's speaking.
Yeah. Mormon's editorial hand is really showing in these verses. And yeah, at times, given the parallel timelines and the skipping back and forth, sometimes I really wish I could be like, hey, Mormon, just go time order. Just trust me.
Yeah, just start with Zenith.
But it's one of those things that you kind of, it's helpful to go look at a chart. Go yeah, look at a chart and see how people have plotted this out, because you'll yes, see where everything splits up and then comes back together.
Yes. If you're a visual person, that will help a lot more than anything I could describe to you. So Limhi and Ammon are having this conversation after Limhi has spoken to his people. And Limhi says, he causes their records that they have been keeping since Zenith to be brought before Ammon so that Ammon can read them. And Ammon's like, wow, this is really great. And then the king, Limhi, asks him if he can interpret languages. And Ammon's like, oh, nope, I can't do that one. I can just read what you wrote. And then Limhi says, well, because when we sent a search party out to try to find our way back to Zarahemla, they didn't find you guys, but they found another land that I was talking about a minute ago that we find out later is the destroyed Jaredite civilization. And they find breastplates and swords and hilts and blades and engravings on 24 gold plates. He's like, we can't read them. We're just dying to know what's on them. So if you know anyone who can translate, I would love to know what's on these plates. You can see Limhi's kind of his personality of curiosity kind of coming through. And I love seeing this in Limhi, that he's really excited to know these new things.
It's interesting because based off the timeline when Xenoph would have left, it seems like Mosiah would have already translated the account of Coriantumr that the Zarahemlaites had, that the large stone was brought to him and he interpreted. And so it seems like that's because that's Mosiah 1.
It's Mosiah 2.
Nope.
Because they don't get those plates.
Nope. They don't get the plates, but the big stone with Coriantumr.
Oh.
Right? When Mosiah comes to Zarahemla, at some point, they're like, hey, by the way, there was this guy, Coriantumr. He hung out with us for like 9 weeks, or, you know, 9 months, and there's a big stone, and
we can't read it.
So we've got this record. And so he goes and translates it. This is a really, like, weird. Again, we've got weird stuff. So it's possible that we've got Xenoph, or is it Limhi? Limhi remembering some of that, and he's like, is this the same thing? Mm-hmm. He might have, yeah, I mean, I don't know if he makes that connection. I think there's a couple, like, little clues that might suggest where he's like, I'm desirous that these records should be translated. Perhaps they will give us a knowledge of the remnant of the people who have been destroyed, where these records came from.
He says he wants to know the cause of their destruction. And I can imagine a few different motivations, right, for wanting to know that. First off, you live in this land. Did they die from a disease? They die from...
Probably war. I think they have a pretty good indication that it's war, right?
Right. But I'm just saying, if you're living in a land and you find out that someone lived there before and their entire civilization has been destroyed, you want to know what caused that because you don't want that to happen to your people, right? That's a deep primal fear.
This raises the biggest question for me is because Mosiah the First has the Urim and Thummim. Oh, it's not called the Urim and Thummim, right? It's called the Translator. Maybe it's called the Seer Stones at this point. I don't remember, but I don't think it's called Urim and Thummim.
He has wherewith that he can look and translate.
Interpreters. That was the word that I was looking for. He gets that at the same time that, maybe he gets it at the same time that he finds the big stone, or maybe he has it from some other thing. But there, it seems to be like, oh, well, maybe the group in Zarahemla still had these things. And so you've only got the Nephite, you know, kingship stuff with the Sword of Laban and the brass plates and the Liahona. And now you've got this fourth sort of sacred artifact, but it's not part of the Nephite group. It's this other thing that the Nephite kings can still use, but it's not associated with Nephite kingship. We're going to learn a little bit more about that. But then why wasn't that with these gold plates? Why did the people of Zarahemla appear to be the ones who had the interpreters when Aether, who hides up the record, doesn't leave the interpreter with them? So there's some weird thing that happens. I think the best suggestions that I've seen have been that Coriantumr must have had the interpreters, or maybe the interpreters were with the rock that Coriantumr had. Why didn't Aether, who probably would have had them because he's the one keeping the records of, you know, the Jaredite people, why didn't he have them with the 24 plates? Did he just know? You know, okay, sure, God can move the interpreters wherever they need to be, right?
Yeah.
I'm totally willing to accept that. Or maybe Mosiah had some other interpreter, and all interpreters belong to the same sort of class of Urim and Thummim, right? Mm-hmm. And so they all belong to the same genus, and so one is the same as the other. Anyways. Yeah.
Interesting.
More cork boards, more connections. If I could just ask Bruno and I, our Mormon, you know, hey, what's going on here? I would love that. But
yes.
Don't have that opportunity.
So Limhi and Ammon have a conversation about seers versus revelators and prophets. And being a seer is a gift from God. And I think Joseph Smith gets his description of how he says he translated the Book of Mormon straight from here. And it just says, and it is a gift from God, being able to translate. And Ammon says that a seer is a revelator and a prophet also, and a gift which is greater can no man have except he should possess the power of God, which no man can. Yet a man may have great power given him from God. And so these things that a seer can know of things which are past and which are to come, and secret things shall be made manifest. And so just sort of this, that's the role of a seer, and I think that's sort of the basis of what we call seership in the church, and prophets, seers, and revelators. So,
yes, I don't think that this seership designation is one that we can go port over to the Old Testament. In fact, the way that the Hebrew Bible uses seer is somewhat different, but that's one of those, like, again, is this a translation thing? Is this a theological thing, a doctrinal thing? A bit hard to tell, but the thing that intrigues me most, and again, I'm sorry to go on another little connector here, but I hope people find this interesting, because what is Limhi's reaction to Ammon talking about this? He says he rejoices. He says, doubtless a great mystery is contained within these plates, and these interpreters were doubtless prepared for the purpose of unfolding all such mysteries to the children of men. Okay, mystery. We've already seen Nephi was interested in the mysteries of God. We've got that indication very, very early on. Mystery keeps showing up. And what is mystery associated with? It's associated with the temple and priesthood and covenant making. And it's so interesting because he says that. Why is Limhi guessing that? Why is he guessing that these 24 plates have anything to do with some great mystery, right? And maybe he doesn't think specifically temple, but he just gathered his people to the temple, so he's got some familiarity with the temple. Maybe he sees some symbols and signs in the plates that he's like, hey, wait a second, this is associated with some of this temple iconography. Maybe I can't understand all the words, but I can catch a word here or there. Maybe there are symbols carved into them, that sort of thing. And so it's so interesting because we get from the record the story of the brother of Jared. And what's the story of the brother of Jared? Well, he goes up on a mountain. He communes with God. God reaches his hand out. Brother Jared identifies it correctly. And then the veil's parted. He's allowed to see God. There's a question and answer session. And he gets to see through the veil. I mean, that's the temple. That's temple themes. There's no question that that is what the temple is all about. And if you have that understanding and have the idea that this is a temple text, and then you remember that one of the reforms that Josiah made to the temple was taking down the Asherah, the groves, the sacred trees, and this is something, again, that's made clear again and again, the sacred tree in the temple was not some cultic grove, it was the menorah, and the menorah represented the divine feminine. Well, what else is the divine feminine associated with? Wisdom, right? And what does he say next? Oh, how marvelous are the works of the Lord, etc., etc. For they will not seek wisdom, neither do they desire that she should rule over them. I just want to know, Limhi, how did you know? How did you know that was in there, right? And so there was a recent quote-unquote discovery that I think is mostly people pretty much think it's a forgery or debunked or whatever. But it's interesting that the forgers chose to make some gold plates that were roughly around the time of Lehi's leaving Jerusalem in that area. And one of the symbols that they put in there was the menorah. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, well, why would you figure on that? And then here in the Book of Mormon, we just happen to have a story about this guy who sees gold plates and associates them with wisdom, the feminine divine, the sacred tree. And I mean, again, if he has the brass plates, if he has some record of First Nephi, where Nephi's dream was the tree of life, which is associated with the mother of God, there's so many of these little breadcrumbs that you just, if you just say, hey, we talk a lot about the hermeneutics, right? Hermeneutics are the method and lens through which you interpret scripture. And so if you put on your glasses, if you put on the temple glasses, if one is, you know, maybe setting a bow on a rim. if you put on your own interpreters, what are they going to show you? And I think if we put on the interpreters that were prepared by God, they're going to show you the temple in the Book of Mormon. They're going to show you the divine feminine that people have taken out. There's more. There's more coming. I don't know that I have too much more in this part, but we're going to have more throughout the whole Book of Mormon. And I just think it's something that I've tried to do more and more ever since I originally read, actually, the lectures that Nibley gave. We've got some recorded lectures, you know, for a semester or something that Nibley gave on the Book of Mormon. And when he did that, he had John Welch take over for the sermon at the temple in 3rd Nephi. And John Welch, I don't know if he published his book or articles before or after he taught this class, but he identified the sermon of the temple as a temple text. And the parallels, he came up with, I think, more than 100 parallels. He gives it like step by step, everything that happens. And so that was the first time when I was like, oh, like there is some temple in the Book of Mormon. And then this year, I've really tried to keep those interpreters on. That's my lens. And it's like, oh, whoa, actually, it's all over the Book of Mormon. It's all here. And not just in a vague sort of like, yeah, you gotta, you know, worship God. There's the house of God. No, no, no. It's like very specific themes that keep showing up over and over. The divine feminine, God's presence with you, your interaction with God. These sort of things are what they're trying to think, because the Book of Mormon is all about teaching people about covenants. And what do covenants do? They tie us to God. They bring us back to Him. And what does the temple do? It invites you to come back to Him in a very real and personal way.
Beautifully said. Thank you. Then we get a little bridge from Mormon telling us that the next few chapters are the record of Zeniff, an account of his people from the time they left the land of Zarahemla until the time that they were delivered out of the hands of the Lamanites. So it's chapters 9 through 22 here in Mosiah. So we're going to be in this record for a little while. And so this is another kind of insertion that Mormon is giving. So we're getting the next few chapters in. The first part is from Zeniff, but then anyway, the next couple chapters that we're doing are from Zeniff's perspective, and he's speaking in first person. And I love that he starts it off, "I, Zeniff, having been taught in all the language of the Nephites and having had a knowledge of the land of Nephi." So this should really be more echoes in our mind of 1 Nephi 1:1, of "I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents." And Zeniff is giving his account of who he is and why he's writing things down and what's happening in his life. He tells us some really interesting things about himself in this very first verse. Dan, do you want to outline those for us?
Okay, so he says, "I've been sent as a spy among the Lamanites, that I might spy out their forces, that our army might come upon them and destroy them." Well, okay, if you go back and read in, is it Words of Mormon or is it Omni? I think it's Omni still, because this is when he says, a certain number of people went up to the wilderness to return to the land of Nephi. This is verse 27. "For there was a large number who were desirous to possess the land of their inheritance, wherefore they went up to the wilderness." They don't mention, Amalekite, the record keeper, doesn't mention the fact that they're going to spy and prepare for one of the only times that I can think of that the Nephites are planning an offensive war. They go out of their way all the time to say, "No, no, no, we're doing this for defense. We're doing this because the Lamanites are coming upon us. It's the only hope." This is where he's saying, "No, no, no, we're spying this out so we can get to know the lay of the land so that we can prepare things and we can go attack," right? Which this is going to set up, because the next thing that happens is going to be an internal group fight. But Zeniff goes and he does his spying and he sees things that are good among them. And so I wonder if he's realized, like, oh, actually, you know, we talk about how the Lamanites have been taught by the tradition of their fathers to just hate us continually. And to some extent they do, but not every Lamanite. They don't necessarily deserve to be destroyed. We don't need to get in a war with them all. And Zeniff's like, oh, hey, a little bit later, another little corkboard string moment. Zeniff's able to go to the king right away. Is it possible that during these initial spying things, he ingratiates himself to the person who was going to become king?
Entirely possible, yeah.
Or some other. Because he goes back and he says, actually, hey, to his brethren in the wilderness, right? After this, he says, no, no, we need to make a treaty with them. He's got a ruler and he's like, no, 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 we don't need to fight them. We don't need a war. But the leader's like, no, 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 we got to wipe these guys out. And in fact, the fact that you don't agree with that, we're going to wipe you out. And luckily he is saved. But this is one of the points where I think this might be what Zeniff or what Limhi was referring to when he talked about the contentions among themselves that they, you know, under the shedding of blood. I think this is what he's referencing, right?
Yeah, they're starting this whole project with infighting and murder. So yeah.
After they get to the land of Nephi, they go back to the land of Zarahemla. But, and this is, I mean, this is just the most tragic phrase, I think, for Zeniff. Because he says, "I being overzealous to inherit the land of our fathers." I mean, he's got a little bit of an insight, and I don't know exactly when he recorded all of these things, but he later says he gives up the kingdom to Noah, his son. He had to know that Noah was not going to do much good for the kingdom. So I wonder if he's like, you know, in spite of everything, even though we did have some periods of peace and we did get to retain, you know, come back and inherit the land of the fathers, was it worth it? I don't know. I think that this phrase right here, "I being overzealous," might be a little introspective, like, hey, actually, I probably shouldn't have done this.
I got a little too excited.
Yeah, but he managed to get another group, which is another wild thing because he's like, hey, our first group, we went down there. It was all good until I said we shouldn't wipe them out. And then we started killing each other. And then he's like, would you like to go try with again. Me? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that is pretty wild.
I don't know. That's and then they go to the journey and they're immediately afflicted with famine and sore afflictions, right? And they're slow to remember God. Such a weird... I think Zenith might be the most tragic character in the Book of Mormon, because I think he does have good aims, but I think he completely ignores the fact that God brought them out of the land of Nephi.
Right.
Or Lehi-Nephi, as we'll see it referred to here. Or Nephi-Lehi, yeah. I don't remember, but... God brought him out for a reason, but he's like, no. So, I mean, I can understand his desire to go home, but I think he maybe misunderstands what the whole point was.
Yeah, I definitely feel that his tragic flaw is just his focus on trying to get back to this first covenant land, the first place of their inheritance, their promised land. And he does seem to ignore the fact that once God leads you out of that land, that's not the promised land anymore. But he's really obsessed with getting back to what this was. And I think Zenith is a good man with a good heart, and I really admire his desire to see and recognize the good in people. And like, maybe he's just too optimistic. You know, he just believes too much in people that he shouldn't. Maybe that's why he makes his son Noah king, is that he just really believes that he's better than he is, and believes that the king of the Lamanites will keep this promise, this treaty that he makes with him. Anyway, so I really feel for Zenith. I think he has a good heart, but he definitely has his tragic flaws that show up here in the story, and his people really pay for it.
Yeah. So again, we get this, okay, his people, after many days wandering, which probably not the 40 days later, because he's already made this trip once. Presumably he knows, but he still describes it as wandering. So it makes me wonder if the terrain between Nephi-Lehi or Lehi-Nephi and Zarahemla is actually pretty treacherous. There's something going on in this wilderness, in this topography, that is difficult to get around. You get easily turned around until you get to the hill in Shimlon, maybe. That's the only sudden landmark that you get. They manage to camp back. And then he goes again with four of his men to the city. This is an interesting thing that we'll see Ammon do later with three of his people.
Such a small group.
That's such an interesting period, interesting parallel, I think, because he comes in with four men into the city and he goes into the king, that he might know the disposition of the king. Okay, how is he that bold? And he's not thrown into prison? That's where I'm like, oh, he was a spy. Maybe he knew the king or knew a trusted advisor and so was able to get the ear of the king. And so he was able to go and say, like, hey, look, can we come in, possess the land? And again, maybe he's too trusting because he trusts that the king will keep his word. And honestly, the king does keep his word for a while.
12 years, yeah.
Yeah. So the king, King Laman, presumably, if they're keeping up with the king naming, although we'll see another King Laman later who might be his son or the next king.
They name him in verse 13,
okay.
King Laman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he covenants that he might possess the land of Lehi-Nephi and the land of Shilom. So some portion of the original Lehi-Nephi plus a little bit more, which I've seen some people suggest that maybe Lehi-Nephi is actually a different place, or maybe Lehi-Nephi is just the renaming of Nephi by the Lamanites who came in after, you know, the Nephites left. But that raises another question, which is there have got to be some Nephites left here. I think I said in last week's episode or the one before that, I don't remember, but I suggested that maybe, you know, we don't know what happens to the Nephites who didn't leave for Zarahemla. Well, I think I might redact that. I think we might actually do, because we get the distinguish from Jake, the demarcation from Jacob, where he's like, oh, for ease of what I'm going to say, everyone who follows with Nephi and his people, I'm going to call Nephites. And everyone who follows with not Nephi and his people, I'm going to call Lamanites. And so the moment that they don't follow Nephi's people, led by Mosiah, that not following turns you into a Lamanite. And so when he talks about these Lamanites, they're probably a bunch of Nephites.
I mean, that's possible. I don't know that that's the most likely interpretation, but it's certainly possible. Because they name their king Laman.
Well, here's the thing is, those people who didn't go with Mosiah and his group, we don't know anything about what their disposition was. So
it's true.
maybe they were like, hey, rather than be taken over, maybe you can just be our king and we'll just
assimilate.
Yeah. For better or worse, which presents an interesting parallel to what's going to happen with Zenith and his people.
Right.
Because they had to come back and now they've got sort of the special treatment, but it's all a trick. Right.
Yeah. So I do have to say that in verse 11, so he says that they had dwelt in the land for the space of 12 years. So this is not, you know, turning around 1 year later. This is 12 long years that King Laman began to grow uneasy, lest by any means my people should wax strong in the land and that they could not overpower them and bring them into bondage. This kind of reminded me of Pharaoh in Egypt, that they have this agreement between the two of them and then this outside people who don't really seem to assimilate start to build up their own culture and their own ideas, and it starts to threaten the powers that be. And that's where it gets dangerous. And that's when he decides that, I mean, this is Zenith's interpretation, right? We're not getting King Laman's side of the story, but his interpretation is that his people are so prosperous and they do so well in the land that that's what makes Laman uneasy. He's like, oh, they're going to take over our land soon. So we better like beat them down.
Verse 12, they were a lazy and idolatrous people. I've got a big question mark. What do they mean by idolatrous here? We don't get any indication of what the idols that they're worshiping are. Desires to bring us in bondage that they might glut themselves with the labors of our hands, that they might feast themselves upon the flocks of our field. Of course, this is King Benjamin gave a discourse about exactly the opposite. So it makes me wonder if Mormon's adding a little emphasis on some of these things that he's finding. But King Laman began to stir up his people. There began to be wars and contentions. Well, does this match up? Here's the thing. I haven't mapped this out like timeline-wise. Does this match up when the Lamanites are fighting Bosiah and King Benjamin?
We know so very little about that time that I don't know, but probably.
So, could it be, again, just another little corkboard and red string, could it be that the economic pressures of the overextension of the Lamanite war against Mosiah and Benjamin are taxing the Lamanites so much that they're like, why are we fighting when we could just, there's this Nephite colony in our land. Why don't we just take it? This is going to be way easier than trying to fight those guys who were 20 to 40 days away through past hills and all sorts of other stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
That is a really interesting idea.
Just a coincidence, though. Just to, I mean, you know.
Yeah. So then he details how the attacks begin, right? In the 13th year, the south of the land of Shiloh, Moriah people were watering and feeding their flocks and tilling their lands. So just minding their own business, doing their own thing. A numerous host of Lamanites came upon them and began to slay them and to take off their flocks and the corn of their fields. And these are not warriors. They're just farmers. They're just regular colonist farmer people. And they weren't even armed. So they flee to the city, like they're, you know, in settlements around the outside, and they flee into the city to get protection. And he arms them. And he says, all manner of weapons which we could invent. So they're having to come up with things, you know, on the fly. Anything that'll work, grab your frying pan kind of thing. I and my people did go forth against the Lamanites to battle, yea, in the strength of the Lord. Did we go forth to battle against the Lamanites? For I and my people did cry mightily to the Lord that he would deliver us out of the hands of our enemies. For we were awakened to a remembrance of the deliverance of our fathers. So they are defending themselves and their homes and their families. They didn't ask for this conflict. And so this is a justified use of violence in defense of their homes. Not necessarily sanctified, but justified.
Well, yeah. This is where I really think it's just, I mean, he lived 12 years among the Lamanites. We haven't lived in our current house for 12 years, and I feel pretty settled. So I can only imagine that after 12 years with a king that he had a relationship enough to where he could covenant with him, that all of a sudden this turn on them. I mean, this is the truly tragic thing. And what was the initial thing that Zenith was the one who said, no, we can't, let's not fight the Lamanites. Let's just make a treaty with them.
Yeah.
And for 12 years, he's been right. And now he's like everything. I can't imagine the absolute collapse of trust that Zenith goes through here. And we're going to see, because this is not the last time that this is going to happen to Zenith.
He does turn to the Lord in his grief, though. Like, he turns to the Lord and puts his trust in the Lord. and encourages his people to do the same. And if we can trust these numbers here, and I don't have any reason not to, they lose 279 of Zenith's people, which had to have been a huge loss for us. I mean, we don't know the size of their settlement, but it couldn't have been that big. And they slay 3,043 of the Lamanites.
Yeah. I mean, that's a...
There's a big disparity.
I don't have too much to say about that, except to say that Zenith, having his total trust betrayed, then goes in and begins to make weapons of war.
And sets up guards. They didn't have guards before because he trusted their treaty.
Yep. An interesting note about these guards, right? He guarded his people and his flocks, kept them from falling in the hands of the enemies. Okay, the Lamanite flock raiding tradition is an interesting thing. Get that, you know, he'd inherit the land of a father for many years, yea, for the space of 20 and 2 years. So I think that this probably includes the initial 12-year period, and that he gets 10 more years before things fall out.
Deteriorate again.
But then he says, thus we did have continual peace in the land for a space of 20 and 2 years. So it's hard to tell. Does he mean, is this 34 years or is this 22 years? I don't know. I think you can kind of read it either way. It just depends on what you mean by continual peace. And so King Laman dies, his son begins to reign in his stead, and now we get this rebellion against his people, which is interesting because when Benjamin dies, the Zarahemla Nephites experience 3 years of peace, the best peace that they ever got. When King Laman dies, that ends a big period of peace for these former Zarahemla Nephites and Zarahemlaites.
I think rebellion is a very interesting word in that verse, because rebellion implies violence against an existing power structure. Like, it implies some authority. And maybe it was just a word choice, but to me that word would imply that the people of Zenith have some sort of authority over the Lamanites, or at least that the Lamanites perceive that they do. I think that's a strange word choice in there. I don't see rebellion reflected in the power structures of this community, but I'm definitely not seeing the whole picture here.
I think what this may have to do with is the covenant that he had made. And so the covenant is
rebellion against the treaty.
It's a lawful treaty, this covenant that they've made. And so the rebellion is not against some Nephite power structure, but against the treaty that had been established.
I see. That makes more sense. He has spies that he sends out that they figure out that they're going to come against them in war again. And
he sends out spies. And remember, he started as a spy. So he still has that spycraft going for him.
That's right.
That's how he knows, oh, well, let's send him to Shimlon, because he knows that Shimlon's where you get the real juicy secrets.
Yeah. Well, he does say that I might discover their preparations. And this, in direct contrast to what he said he was sent to do, he says that I might guard against them, that they might not come upon my people and destroy them. So he's not trying to go out and destroy them. He's trying to discover what they're doing so they can't surprise them. I think he very purposely draws that contrast there.
I believe you are correct. Yes.
In a very heartrending description that could come straight out of a Lord of the Rings movie at Helm's Deep, I think. Caused that the women and children of my people should be hid in the wilderness. And I also caused that all my old men that could bear arms, and also all my young men that were able to bear arms, should gather themselves together to go to battle against the Lamanites. This is apocalyptic. This is everything. You know, they have to put their all into this. And he says that we did go up in the strength of the Lord to battle.
Yeah, this is an interesting speech, because I can feel the tension within Zenith here, because he's like, well, the Lamanites, they don't know anything about the Lord. They don't know the strength of the Lord. They depend on their own strength. They're wild, ferocious, bloodthirsty people. They believe in the tradition of their fathers. So there's this almost dehumanizing language, wild, bloodthirsty people. But then it's like, no, this is because of the traditions of their fathers. They believe that they were wronged in Jerusalem, that they were wronged in the wilderness, that they were wronged in the crossing of the sea, that they were wronged while in the land of their first inheritance, right? And then he says, no, but they don't understand that this was because Nephi was more faithful and more favored.
Right.
And the land of the first inheritance, where is that now? The Nephites don't have it. The Lamanites had it, and now they're in Nephi Lehi. So where is the land of the first inheritance? We don't know. There's a lot of theories and speculations.
I do think it's really interesting what he outlines here, what you just said about what the Lamanites believe, because this is the first glimpse that we get, I think, that a Nephite truly understands what a Lamanite's position is in relation to the Nephites, right? They really understand what they believe about them. You can truly understand someone else's position when you can restate it to them and they can say, yes, that is what I believe. Yes, that's what I think, right? So you can truly understand it without bias. And I think that's what Zenith is showing us that he can do here, how fair-minded he is and how he can be like, well, if this is what they think really happened, well, of course they hate us. Whereas before, it doesn't seem like anyone since probably Jacob made much effort to understand why the Lamanites hated the Nephites. It was sort of dismissive. It was just like, oh, that's just how they are. They're just wicked or they're just whatever. And Zenith gives us a real glimpse here that he does understand why they hate them. He doesn't say it's okay. Well, clearly there are some things they don't understand and there were some pieces missing, but if that's what they've been taught, that's what they're going to believe. I find that incredibly, not just optimistic and trusting, but just Zenith really believes in the good in people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he has to do this because he's framing this upcoming fight. I mean, he remembers the fight that they had 10 or 22 years ago where his people were wildly successful, killing 3,000 and losing 200. And so I think he's framing this as I think what it is he's preparing himself to both justify this, that he's saying, look, this is what they believe, and they're not going to stop. We thought we were good for 12 years, and then we thought we were good for 10 or 22 more. Yeah. They are not going to stop, and this is the only way that he knows how. He doesn't consider the fleeing option.
Yeah.
And so this sort of preparatory speech is a manifestation of this inner conflict that he has, where at one point he was willing to be the one to say, no, we can't fight the Lamanites. We can't go in and slaughter them. And now he says, no, okay, I've seen what's happened. I've seen where this has put me. Again, justifying this violence, not sanctifying, but justifying this. And I think I don't think anyone can say like, oh, Zenith, you didn't do enough. Right? You didn't try hard enough.
Yeah.
I think he was put in an almost impossible situation. And maybe, yes, maybe they could have done what the anti-Nephi Lehi's did. But I don't know that he had that sort of model even available. So yeah. It's hard to say, well, why didn't he step out of this paradigm? Okay, well, yeah, you get that benefit from, you know, where we are now. But again, this is where I think Zenith is just the most tragic character. And this is after his success, quote unquote, against driving the Lamanites out of the land, slaughtering them so great that they didn't even bother numbering them. They come back to their own land to tend flocks and till the ground. And you kind of think, oh, well, things are going okay. And he says, now I, being old, did confer the kingdom upon one of my sons. We don't get the name of that son, but that's about to be probably as bad, if not worse, than all the violence that he's had to commit in defense of his people. If he knew what's going to happen to his people as a result of King Noah, I think that just is the cherry on top of the overzealous Zenith, his tragic history.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to see someone like Noah come from someone like Zenith, especially in contrast to Mosiah, Benjamin, Mosiah, and then we get Zenith and Noah and Limhi, and how just one generation not following in the ways that are set before them, how much suffering that can cause. And in contrast to Benjamin's, you know, how great the rejoicing of the people was when they made that covenant and took upon themselves the name of Christ. Anyway, so yeah, I think Zenith is a real sympathetic figure here, and I just wish he could have lived in a more peaceful time. He could have been, he was clearly a great leader to his people. What other paths could he have had if he hadn't had that overzealousness to inherit and live in that particular land? If his obsession with city, you know, living in that land had quelled itself and he could find other worthy pursuits in his life.
Well, this is just another point where I got to hand it to Mormon. His foreshadowing, you know, again, I've complained a little bit about his editorial hand, but
there is some wonderful storytelling that happens in all of this. And there's enough room, as you may have seen tonight, that you can really dig in and get a little bit speculative. But even just if you don't want to get as speculative as I've gotten, I think you can still read this as just this tragic, it's deeply ironic, where we know sort of some of the things that are going to happen because we've read the Book of Mormon before, where Zenef doesn't know. And so there's this deep irony that Mormon is setting up for us that I think really is just, again, when we talk about the Book of Mormon, there's some aspects of it that are tragic. And there's some aspects of it that are comedic. And I don't mean that to say funny, right? But there are some funny parts. But to say that what the ultimate result of the story is. So I just, this narrative that we're going to get with not just Abinadi, but also Ammon and his people. Like the next through most of the rest of Mosiah is some of the most.
Until we bring everybody back to Zarahemla.
It's just, it's intricate. It's deep. It's complex. There's a lot of questions that I still have. There's some, just a lot of things going on. And so hopefully next week is a big reading block.
Yes. We have to try to get all of Abinadi's story in next week. I mean, it's
going to be tough.
Yeah.
But that is all for this week. And we want to thank you for listening and thank you to our editors for their hard work, especially on this week's episode. Please make sure to rate and review the podcast on your podcast platform of choice and subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. And also share with your friends about our discussions.
You can also join our Facebook group, Latter-Nay Nonviolence, Pacifism, and Peace Studies. There are links in the show notes. And you can check out our website, latterdaypeacestudies.org. And if you click on the Get Involved page, you can find ways to contribute to our efforts. For Latter-Day Peace Studies, I'm Marianne.
And I'm Dan.
See you next week.